Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 153, recorded January 19th, 2012, CES and Laptop Retrospectives. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Ryan Shrout. We are joined by a special guest, Roger Chang, who's filling in for the MIA, Patrick Norton, who had some family emergencies to attend to. How's it going, Roger?
It's doing pretty well, considering it's raining and I'm still recovering from CES from last week.
Yes.
But good.
Yeah, CES recovery takes longer than most people would expect. But apparently that whole... Did you stay through the weekend as well?
I stayed up until Friday, so I got there on a Sunday, the previous Sunday, and I stayed the entire week till Friday, and I was doing pretty well. I will confess, before I left, I had a bit of a flu. I got over that, got on the plane, spent the entire week there. I think I was... doing pretty well.
Yeah.
It's kind of the thing that... it's a gift that keeps on giving.
I was also there. I was there Saturday through Thursday, so I had the same kind of mindset as well. But you know, since CES was just last week, we did Patrick and I did a live show from the show floor there. I just wanted to know, from a maybe like a PC hardware side of things, was there anything that kind of stood out to you in particular from CES, or did you get the feeling that at CES PC hardware was kind of like a non-discussed topic at some level?
I will say that in terms of PC hardware, it was less like what people would remember, say, from like Comdex, where it was very component oriented, and more into a finished kind of consumer electronics product. Vizio, for example, announced a new line. Vizio, the HDTV manufacturer that everyone knows and loves that you buy at Costco and other big box stores, announced a line of very elegantly designed PCs and ultrabooks. And it was very interesting because Vizio, for the longest time, has only been known for their displays. And I think this is kind of a genuine push because from the chatter I've heard, the margins on HDTVs are really thin, even in some cases even thinner than PCs. And so kind of pushing over into yet another really kind of cutthroat market might seem kind of weird until you realize that Vizio does displays. So building an all-in-one PC with a really gorgeous display makes total sense. Building a super thin, you know, ultra notebook with a really gorgeous screen makes sense because that's kind of their forte, is developing the screens. Unfortunately, they were pretty mum on specs, so I couldn't figure out what was actually running inside the machines. But they themselves, the machines themselves were really nice. Really elegant looking, kind of very thin metallic next to no bezel on the screens. And it was kind of a theme that I saw throughout, where a lot of products were kind of the same thing from the previous CES, except this year they were just made more refined, thinner, lighter. So that goes the same thing for notebooks and ultrabooks, I'm sure. It was something that I think every big electronics manufacturer was announcing or showcasing.
If you didn't have an ultrabook, you were missing out on the buzz of the show.
And it was kind of, I mean, it's kind of weird because last year it was tablets. This, everyone's coming out with a tablet, you know, even
that's true.
And so I think, you know, ultrabooks are this year's tablets, I think, hopefully. The thing is, you know, for a lot of what people need PCs for, there's only so much power you actually really need. So everyone was concentrating on new form factors that fit the quote unquote lifestyle, whatever that lifestyle may be, active, homebody or whatever. But, it was a genuine kind of, in many ways, this to me, this hallmarked more of a consumer electronics emphasis on PC design and kind of commoditization than, you know, pre-existing PCs where it was, okay, we have a cool shiny box for you. You know, Alienware, we'll make these really cool, awesome alien-looking cases that, like, work amazing for gaming. In fact, I actually went to an Alienware event the other night, and one of what they were showcasing was a new PC that was a little lower in spec than their high-end rigs, but it was portable. It was essentially a desktop model that you could not only...
Is this the X51?
Yes. I think, was it the X51? Let me see.
It's the one that kind of looks like a console in terms of its size and design style. Yeah. So this, they just announced that this week.
What I found remarkable was their emphasis, well, you can carry this around to your next, you know, LAN gaming party. Or if you don't want it in the, you know, the bedroom or the den, you can move it out into your living room and put it under the TV. And so kind of there's this thought that, you know, PCs now are something that doesn't live in one particular corner of the house. It's kind of an accessory to your, you know, a digital or network lifestyle. They were they had this one setup where they had this HETV and it next to the side of it, and they were showing, I think it was Need for Speed that you could play using the Xbox wireless controllers, because they also tossed in one of those Xbox 360 to USB, wireless 360 to USB connectors for the PC. So you could play like you were playing with an Xbox, except the resolution would be that much greater and the fidelity and all that. But, you know, it wasn't anything brand new in terms of what was inside it, but rather the packaging that was new, or at least right. For them was new.
It's kind of interesting from a hardware perspective. That particular system, the X51, is a Sandy Bridge processor and a mini ITX motherboard. So it's and it actually uses a discrete graphics card, but a fairly kind of mid to budget range discrete graphics card. It does have all your standard type of PC components. It's an H61 motherboard, which is a little bit of a lower cost, lower feature set chipset. But they talk about, you know, boasting being able to replace the processor, being able to replace the graphics card or the hard drive down the road. And, you know, I don't know if maybe you got a little bit more to see what the insides of it actually look like. We just have a single picture posted on our site that kind of shows the interior of it. And it's all, you know, it's cramped in there because you've got a lot of hardware for such a small area. But the idea is pretty neat that, you could upgrade the graphics within the power supply's limits if you want to down the road. You can replace the processor, maybe even to an Ivy Bridge processor, potentially sometime down the road as well. Or if you really just like that case, you can replace it with any mini ITX motherboard, as long as the cooling solution that Alienware has in there would function with your machine. So it's a cool little device. I think it's still a little overpriced. I think the top-end model starts at like $1,199 or something like that. And the graphics you get with it is a part that was basically just designed for this type of product. Like it's called a GTX 555 or something.
They did make a lot of emphasis on the user upgradability, but when you look at it, I mean, you're limited on storage base. So anything you want to do in terms of that, I mean, you're going to have to hang outside the case. And I think you're limited to about 150 watts, whatever that GPU is. I think as long as it does not go over 150, you should be okay. And as long as the cooling design doesn't interfere with the way Alienware put the case together.
Right.
I mean, they did cram a lot into a very small space, but I'm kind of with you on the, I don't know if I would pay that amount of money for what they want when I could still pay that same amount and get something a little, a step up without the Alienware logo on it.
And you know it's going to be upgrade flexible down the road, right? You know if you buy a standard, even if it's a very small ATX form factor case or even mini ATX, micro ATX form factor case, you know it's going to be more upgradable down the line than this type of system will be. Another interesting article that actually went up at PC Per this past week was another, we were talking about retrospectives on CES. This was a retrospective on an old laptop. And I think this would be an interesting kind of topic to discuss on this show. You just mentioned Ultrabooks and all this type of stuff as well. One of my writers, Matt Smith, wrote an article on the Acer Extensa 5420, which is like a five-year-old laptop. I think he bought it in 2007 sometime, so 4.5 years old or so, using pretty outdated hardware, an AMD Turion processor, 2 gigs
wow,
of memory.
Wow, Turion.
Yeah, 160 gig, 5400 RPM hard drive, 15.4-inch screen with a 1280 by 800 resolution, which is like the default resolution for tablets at this point. So, you know, he kind of it was an interesting idea to re-review this notebook in today's market in terms of where is it deficient, where is it maybe better than, maybe where is it still just as good as current machines. And, you know, you mentioned Ultrabooks, and one of the things he talked about with is the performance was lower, yes, but he loved the keyboard on this larger kind of fatter machine because it had more space. You could have basically longer throws on the keys. You could tell when you're hitting keys and that type of stuff. Also, connectivity was a big issue. This one had 4 USB ports, FireWire, S-Video, VGA, headphone, microphone, line-in, express card, PC card, and a memory card reader. And those are the things that you really only get on like workstation class Lenovo machines now. Like if you're buying a business class machine, maybe you'll get those types of connections. So I don't know. I mean, have you thought about any of that kind of stuff? Like where do these old laptops maybe do better? Have we gone too thin to the point of sacrificing a lot of this functionality?
Well, I think it's interesting because you kind of, everything that's built is built for a market. And when you look at a product, especially as it evolves, be it a notebook or a stereo or even an appliance like a washer, dryer, or refrigerator, how it's designed, you can tell a lot about who they're kind of pushing it towards. And what's interesting is back in the day when these laptops came out, they weren't really intended for the home user. They weren't intended for students. They were intended for people who could afford something, but more than just say like a super end notebook, but a notebook that could basically support all these variables. For example, the PC card or the PC Express slot. I mean, my first laptop was an old piece of crap 486 Compaq, and it had a PCM CIA slot, and I thought that was the best thing on the planet. But right, the resolution topped that at 640 by 400, and the only way to go beyond that was to plug in a CRT, and that was like a 14-inch, you know, Wonder I bought for like $150. I think what you see is like, you know, for all the ports and stuff. I mean, I think we've come to the point where everything's kind of USB in some way. Be it your phone, be it a memory card reader, be it any kind of device, even an external drive, right? You just plug into a USB port. Don't have to worry about it. When you have all these ports, you can kind of see at that stage where the industry was in terms of standards and what they had in terms of options for memory. Like if you bought a notebook, if you bought like an Ultrabook right now that had 2 USB ports and they were both USB 3.0, you wouldn't throw up your hands and say, well, I have no expandability options. Well, you can attach an external drive to it and still get relatively decent speed from it. You can plug in a media card reader that supports every media card under the sun into the USB port. You're not going to worry about it. But back then, I mean, you know, you really kind of like, well, you know, I'm going to have CF cards on me. Does this card support CFs or compact flash? Or, you know, SDHC is the new card coming out. Does this laptop support it? Right. You know what? I'm going to need a new hard drive in a couple of years. Is this going to be expandable? Because, you know, what did it come with, like a 4 gig or 40 gig hard drive or something? It's like, you know, maybe I want to upgrade to a 60 or even an 80 or, you know, heaven forbid, 100 gigabyte, you know, hard drive.
Right.
It's, you know, what you see is like, you know, you had all these options because the manufacturer knew that's what people wanted. But as things get smaller, things become more consumer electronics oriented. It's like, you know, no, people are just going to toss these in about 2 years and get a new one. They're not going to really want to upgrade the hard drive. They're not going to really want. I mean, if you look at Apple, Apple's kind of taken that to heart. If you look at their line of machines, you know, outside of their Mac Pro models, you know, the MacBook right I have right now, other than the hard drive and memory, I can't replace the battery easily. You can't really replace the hard drives in the iMacs. I mean, unless you really want to go through the motions and taking off the glass screen and all that. I mean, they're kind of fixed at some point. And I think they understand their market. It's like, well, by the time I upgrade the hard drive, why don't I just get a new computer at the same time? Because it's going to be faster. It's going to have some new gee whiz feature to it. And because external drives connect with USB, I can store everything on that and it won't be such a hassle moving everything back. So I think it's interesting in so much that the market has definitely changed from when that was created. I mean, the pre-existing, the business, the student, the engineer and all that are still there. But now you have lifestyle catering where you have the type of materials is important, like the look and feel like it's a car, or the customizability of the chassis. I want it in a different color, or I want it in a lacquer black so it fits with my persona.
Like you mentioned, cars started out purely as function. Now we've moved well past that. So, a company that's glad that we have this kind of replaceability mentality with computer parts and processors, that kind of stuff, is definitely Intel. They announced, there's no real story behind this, but it's just interesting numbers to report on. Intel had their quarter earnings call, as well as their end of year earnings call. In Q1, apparently, or this past quarter, they had $12.8 billion in revenue, which is with a 64% profit margin, which is huge. And they reported for the full year. This is what I thought was the most interesting statistic. For the full year 2011, their revenue was actually increased by $10 billion over 2010. In a year when a lot of companies had been struggling, when a lot of people expected people to be struggling, especially in the tech field, their revenue increased $2 billion and their profit was up $2.2 billion over that same time period. So they actually made $2.2 billion more in 2011 than they did in 2010. And, they went down into a little bit of detail of which particular markets this was. The only one that had, I would say not negative growth, but was flatlined were the Atom processors that were in netbooks and that kind of stuff, kind of indicating that bubble had reached its peak and that it was starting to decline. So it's interesting just to think about the struggles of a company like AMD as a processor company or as a GPU company for that matter, and then see how dramatically different it can be at Intel. I think they said something like the Sandy Bridge architecture, both its desktop and notebook form, were responsible for like 40% of all of the revenue Intel made. And that's an impressive feat for it to occur in a single year. It basically came out last January. Last CES is when Sandy Bridge was launched. So over the course of that 1 year, they've moved 40% of their company's revenue over to that new architecture. That's a very impressive feat from a business standpoint, that they were able to move so much of their business over to this new design so quickly. That was, again, not really anything really to, I guess, discuss or debate on that. It's just, if you want a job, Intel is probably one of the best places you can go look.
I should have bought stocks years ago, back when they had that when AMD was gaining on them. It says a lot that Intel has managed to profit so well from, especially when competitors like AMD are kind of stumbling a bit. I don't know. I mean, maybe they kind of found what Apple was doing, is that you kind of have a built-in obsolescence to these things where you just like, hey, you know what? Don't worry. Two years or maybe a year and a half down the road, you're just going to upgrade. I mean, if you think about it, I run the same quad core Q6600 I put together back in the summer of 2007. It works fine. I do my web surfing, I do my media playback, I do my DVR recording on it. Does everything perfect. I don't need to upgrade, but every time I walk by a computer store or I go to Newegg, it's like, oh, I should really build a new machine. I don't really need to, but it would be nice because then I get all these new awesome features. I get faster speed. I can do all sorts of things. But, I would probably spend the same amount of time, probably like 80 to 90% of the time surfing the web on it. And for that, I mean, I could have done with a Core 2 Duo or even something simpler. but there's that kind of built-in, that there's that compelling nature that newer is better, newer is faster, newer gives you more choices, more flexibility, freedom, right? You know, it's something that tech companies really need to trade on, because, you know, if people upgraded their computer equipment the same way that people used to upgrade their TVs, which is what, every 7 or 10 years,
yep,
most of these companies would be broke. So they it's like, you know what? Don't cut back on the amount of stuff you record or the amount of TV shows you save. Just buy a new larger hard drive. You know, move everything to it. There's really kind of a compelling, you know, reason to kind of have people store, use more, because, you know, you run out of space, you run out of power, you got something else down the road that you can buy. And I mean, any company knows that, you know, your repeat business is where you make your money. You know, you make the one-off sale. Even car dealerships don't really make money off the car. They make money off car servicing. They want you to come back.
True. Let's talk about GPUs for a little bit. We had talked about previously on This Week in Computer Hardware the Radeon HD 7970. This is the new highest-end GPU from anybody, but it's obviously the top-end GPU from AMD. It's based on a completely new architecture, Southern Islands architecture. Yeah, the reviews for the reference cards actually went up on, December 22nd. Now, right before CES, or right when CES was starting, we were supposed to get the retail availability of these cards. The 7970s are going to be on sale at Newegg and Fry's and all those Micro Center, all those typical places. We did a review of an XFX model that uses non-standard cooling. It had overclocked speeds. It was 1,000 megahertz instead of 925 megahertz. Memory was slightly overclocked. Great card in terms of the cooler was, the custom cooler is nicer looking. It's maybe a little bit quieter, maybe a little bit more efficient, not spectacularly so. Your output connectivity is the same. You've got a dual link DVI, HDMI, and two mini display ports. You can utilize all four of those as long as you have two monitors that support DisplayPort or active DisplayPort adapters. A lot of connectivity options there. It's a good solid card, right? We've already talked about the GPU itself. Performs very well. The clock speed differences going from 925 to 1,000, you know, a handful of percent. You would expect that handful of percent performance increase. That's pretty much all you're going to get. What was interesting in our review is that we were able to test Crossfire for the first time. So doing multiple GPUs, two 7970s. We were a little bit let down by the performance. I don't think we talked about this at CES, so I wanted to mention it here. Crossfire scaling has kind of let us down. There were some instances where it actually worked very, very well. If you look at Dirt 3, if you look at what other games? Metro 2033, Deus Ex Human Revolution. The Crossfire results for those games are very impressive. They scaled close to one-to-one. If you look at those specific Crossfire results, there's actually a separate page for Crossfire results on there. The problem is, in some games, so if we go to the Crossfire Dirt 3 page, you'll see that you're seeing jumps, dramatic jumps in Crossfire scaling. Other games, Battlefield 3 was the most odd game. It scaled at 1680 by 1050 resolution and 1920 by 1200, but not at 2560 by 1600, which is where people would need that kind of scaling the most. It didn't scale at all in Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, which is kind of expected because it's a CPU-bound game. But then Batman Arkham City, it didn't scale at all. And what was the other title we had issue with? Human Revolution, Deus Ex Human Revolution, kind of had some weird dips in it. It was enough of our six games. Three of them scaled well. Three of them were questionable or had problems. And a 50% success rate is not acceptable for somebody who's going to spend $1,100 or $1,200 on video cards. It was a little disappointing, right? And I think this is something that they'll all fix in a driver. It's not an architectural issue. It's not something that requires hardware revisions or anything like that. They will be able to fix it in drivers. But you're talking about a graphics card that retails for, at minimum, $550.
Now, was this something you saw across all the 7970s, that scaling issue?
Well, I only had two. I only have the two okay. Here. So, but I mean, they're basically identical. We tried all kinds of different troubleshooting methods. We had AMD on the phone with us, and they weren't able to give us any solid answers. You know, switching slots on the motherboard. We actually changed different motherboards. We got the same type of results. You know, something like Batman, where it doesn't scale at all, makes sense in my mind, because I go, okay, they haven't updated the driver with a profile to allow for scaling in that particular game. The next driver release in the next 3 weeks or less will probably fix that. That I get. The whole that it didn't scale at 2560 by 1600 on Battlefield 3, that really confuses me, but it did scale at other resolutions. So they have some quirks to work out. And I guess my issue is, I believe that they will work it out. But if you're a gamer who's spending $550 or twice that much to get Crossfire configurations of a card like this, you're also the type, same type of person that's going to buy games day one. You're the type of person that wants your total graphics investment to work on the first day. And it seems that even though AMD has been talking about their gaming initiatives, they haven't been doing it as well as NVIDIA has been doing it. NVIDIA seems to be much faster at getting new drivers out. They seem to be much faster at answering these calls. So yeah, you can see there at Battlefield 3, the blue line that is the 7970 Crossfire configuration actually doesn't really vary at all from the single one, but it did on the other two. So it's really weird. So I gave them, I knocked them on that and said, this is obviously something they need to address if they want to be in the high-end kind of multi-GPU market still, which they do, high profit margins, even if it is low volume. So, I mean, that was a 7970. I know we were kind of talking about this before the show started. Do you really need that much power? There are still instances for it. Multiple display gaming, 2560 by 30-inch display gaming, that type of stuff. Because remember, the 7970 can run three displays at 2560 by 1600 off of a single card if you want. Then you definitely can use as much computing horsepower as you can possibly get for your gaming. But again, not for everybody. And as I did mention this at CES, availability of these cards has been really, really difficult to come by. And I do not think it's because there are tens of thousands of people willing to spend $550 on a graphics card. I think it's because they have some pretty tight availability issues that they need to work out. So we'll see. Actually, I'm going to do Newegg has none in stock. I just wanted to double check. Make sure I was giving accurate information up to the minute.
Yeah, I've always been sort of impressed, but at the same time worried about AMD's ability to. I mean, NVIDIA is of late. I mean, everything I've been hearing is like, you want a new, because I'm in the market to actually upgrade my GPU. I'm running like a 4870. Everyone's just like, if you want a single card, just get this. NVIDIA 480.
580 is the latest one.
It's a previous gen, but it's like low buck enough. Like it's a sub $200.
Okay. They did release some of the 480s like on sale because I know they had a bunch of 480s left over from last year. So yeah, that might have been what they were referring to.
But it just seemed like back when I got the 4870, AMD had the real value proposition in terms of price performance. NVIDIA was like, okay, they got the high end maxed out, but unless you want to spend that kind of money, you're gonna probably settle for something less. And that's where AMD kind of decided to, or ATI kind of focused. But of late, I mean, just everything I've heard, I mean, is it because AMD is so big and they're concentrating on both this GPU and CPU design, where NVIDIA is kind of more focused, even with the Tegra and all that? Or is it just, one of those things where it just swings from one company to the other?
It does. It does just swing from one company to the other. And if you're in the market for a GPU upgrade, I would still, our kind of the other story we're going to talk about was the fact that NVIDIA looks like they are pulling in the release of their next generation GPU because of the pressure put on them by this release. I think that it's called Kepler is the code name for it. And they're probably going to be available now sometime in March, which is close enough for people that may be willing to spend that kind of money on a GPU to hold off a little bit, which is obviously the intent of kind of leaking this information out there and making sure people know that it's coming down the road. There was one piece of information that came out today, actually, from a source that is traditionally very NVIDIA negative. There's a particular website with a particular reporter who tends to be very, let's say they find NVIDIA's flaws. They're not liars. They find NVIDIA's flaws and they make sure everybody knows about them. Well, they're hearing now and they're seeing that the upcoming NVIDIA Kepler is actually going to be a much better GPU than Southern Islands. And the fact that they are saying that actually makes me believe that will be the case. So that's, if you're a high-end GPU enthusiast, that's actually really good news for you. It will hopefully put pressure on AMD. They'll have to lower the price of their cards, and we'll get a little bit more kind of competition going back and forth there. I think it's going to be an interesting spring for graphics cards, because we'll see, you know, you've got this $550 GPU up there, and there's not that many people that are going to spend that much money on a graphics card. But as AMD releases their lower end options based on that same architecture, you know, we'll see prices come down. We'll see like the current gen 580 and 6900 series cards. Those will start to go on sale. Those prices will come down. And I think by the time summer hits, we'll have a completely different landscape for graphics cards and PCs, for gaming PCs. So,
I mean,
but it is one of those things that just kind of swings back and forth pretty regularly, which is good. That's what we want. Like, you want that kind of competition to go back and forth. You don't want it to be what it has been on the CPU side, where Intel has been dominant for so long that there's not a real big push to kind of move things in any particular direction.
Yeah, hopefully, all I'm really hoping for is a sub-$200 card that will allow me to play Diablo 3 and BioShock Infinite in moderate to high resolution, or with all the eye candy turned on.
That, I don't think that will be a problem. I think for the immediate future, that's, you know, $200 graphics cards be more than enough to do like 1080p or 19x12 gaming. Another little interesting thing I'll hit on before we get into a couple of emails. Intel released a new pilot program that kind of is odd. So processor manufacturers, GPUs, CPU guys, whatever, they always take a, we don't support overclocking. If you overclock it, it's not our problem. Void your warranty, all that kind of stuff. Well, Intel actually launched a performance tuning protection plan that is aimed at users of K-series and X-series processors, the unlocked and kind of overclockable friendly processors. While the company is stressing that they do not officially endorse overclocking or otherwise running CPUs out of spec, the performance tuning protection plan is an additional service that can be added in addition to, though separate from, existing warranties, where Intel will furnish a free replacement processor to any user that unintentionally damages their processor as a result of overclocking or increasing the voltage. So that's interesting. They'll charge you anywhere from $20 to $35. You register your CPU with them. And then if you fry it from overclocking, they will send you a one-time replacement. Now, we had this kind of debate amongst our team trying to figure out, is this Intel doing a nice guy thing? You know, they're making $10 billion a year or something like that. Are they trying to like give back to this community and say, yeah, we can afford to do this at a moderate price? Is it them trying to make more money on this type of like retail big box insurance program upsell that you always get when you go to someplace like Best Buy? What are your thoughts on this? I mean, is it?
It really feels like an upsell. I mean, it's a one time only. So say you fry your CPU, you get the second, you get the replacement, and that's it. I mean, if you fry it again, I mean, you're not getting a second replacement, as it were. And it's a one time fee, or is it? I was trying to find out if it was a one time fee or is it was like a subscription based fee.
It's a one time fee. So you pay if you buy the highest end CPU, the Core i7-3960, the new Sandy Bridge E part that is a $1,000 processor, you pay $35 for the insurance.
I think they just want to sell more. It's kind of weird. It almost sounds like they're giving consumers, or at least potential buyers, kind of a get out of free jail card if you happen to blow your CPU when you overclock it, thereby making people say, you know what, that high end CPU, you know, $400 or $500, you know what, I at least if I do anything to this, I'll get a replacement. And so you encourage people to kind of move up to the next level in terms of their CPU purchase.
True.
So instead of saying like, you know, I might fry this chip anyway, I might as well just go with something cheap. I can get something very expensive. And chances are, I'm sure Intel binned enough of these into a decent condition that they probably won't have too many returns, I think, unless they really didn't think this out and, you know, the returns are like 50% or higher.
Right, right. They did say it's a pilot program. I think they're only offering it for like
other expensive CPUs, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it goes down to the 2500K, which is only selling for like 230 or something like that, 240. So a mid-range part, I guess I'll call it. But they're only going to offer it for a few months, and they're going to see how the program is. I'm sure that's what they're seeing is like, are we going to lose our ass on this? Well, then we won't do this anymore, but they are starting it. So it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting kind of twist.
They are definitely, I think they're definitely testing the waters to see what the reaction is, to see how well it does for them, but more importantly, to see if buyers will embrace it. If it does, it could definitely open doors for them. I mean, you know, back in the 80s, Nintendo made a killing with their little Nintendo repair center thingy, where, you know, if your NES was acting up, you bring it over to the store, and there's this little official NES, you know, repair outlet or something, and you give them $20 or whatever to check out your machine. I mean, it's great. It's like you're continually getting the person to pay over and over again.
Agreed. Who as a company would not like that? Let's take a quick break here before we jump into at least a few emails that we have time for and thank today's sponsor of the show, our good friends at Netflix. And they're a frequent sponsor of the show. They're a frequent sponsor on the Twit Network. If you have not tried out Netflix, you are really missing the boat here, guys. And how many times can we offer you a free 30-day trial by going to netflix.com/twit? That's the URL you've got to go to. Now, the Netflix streaming service is really, really cool. They have thousands of TV episodes and movies. You know, they stream directly to you on all kinds of devices instantly, wherever you need to be, wherever you are, right? So you can stream them through your console, your 360, PlayStation 3, Wii. You can stream them through, of course, your PC or your Mac. They have an iPad app. They have an iPhone app. More and more Android devices are supporting streaming Netflix as well. Not all of them, but quite a bit of them, or quite a few of them are now. I think most of the newer ones are. You can get a Roku box. You can get an Apple TV. A lot of people's DVD players and Blu-ray players and TVs actually have this capability built into it. So you just associate that application on whatever your device is to your account. You can go online and set up all your lists and queues and then access them on that device. It's very cool. You can stream as many movies as you want, as often as you want. You can watch the same thing over and over again, which is great if you have kids. You can watch a different thing every night, which is great if you're like me and you just kind of have insomnia sometimes and you just need to put something on. You know, you're not paying per movie or per show, so you don't have to worry about not finishing the end of that show. And one other great feature of it is that it's kind of, I kind of call it like an instant DVR functionality, kind of a mobile DVR functionality. You can start watching a show at home, say before you go to work. You got to leave, you got to go catch the bus, you got to catch some kind of public transit. Take your phone with you, take your iPad with you. Boom, you can finish watching that on the way to work. You can do that. You can finish watching it when you get to your hotel room if you're out of town for work. There's all kinds of great ways for you to utilize the service. It's really an impressive way to watch media, and I think it really changed the way that you interact with this type of media, right, if you're kind of over the way regular TV tends to work. So, again, that address is netflix.com/twit. You get a free 30-day trial. Be sure to use that URL when you sign up, netflix.com/twit. Helps us out, helps the network out. We really appreciate that. If you're not happy with the service, you can cancel it at any time. We don't think you're going to have that problem. Once you try it, I think you'll become as addicted to the service as everybody else that tends to use it. So we thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So let's get into at least a handful of emails before the episode is over, because I know we didn't do any last week because we were at CES and they've been kind of piling up. If you want to send us an email, we highly encourage it. We need all of your input, all of your questions and your feedback. Twitch at twit.tv. That's T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. So let's go in here. And actually, ironically, Roger, if you want to read our first email here from Austin, who is looking for a notebook with a lot of connectivity.
So Austin writes, he says, "Hey guys, I'm in the market for a laptop, but I have a few requirements. Number one, I need to have a FireWire port or maybe an Express port with the ability to attach a FireWire card. Two, I would like to use this laptop to play some high-end games at a reasonable level. Three, I would like to keep the laptop under $1,500. Four, I would like to have it a 1080p screen, and five, 14 or 15-inch screen. I know that FireWire is all but dead, but I use FireWire to connect my PreSonus audio device for for recording." So he really wants the FireWire. So
that might be the hardest thing to keep, right? I mean,
I was digging around Dell and HP, and actually I've not gotten to Lenovo. I got my dad a Dell laptop 2 years ago that actually had an Express card slot. I tried using a FireWire card with it. Let's just say the performance was less than spectacular, even for FireWire. But, I mean, it's one of those things where I've just traditionally, especially for FireWire compatibility, I hate to say, you know, it's not that I hate to say it, but I will admit that's why I lean toward Macs, because, you know, for the longest time, they've always supported at least FireWire 400 in their notebook, or at least in their higher end notebooks, their MacBook Pros. I'm not too sure about PCs, because most of them, the ones that do support it, tend to give you the 1394A adapter, which is a little 4-pin one, the little thin one. If your audio devices need juice as well, I'm not sure if you need an extra dongle to power those. Especially for under $1,500, that has my gears working.
Yeah, it's tough, because we're getting into that thing where FireWire specifically is kind of an older connection. It's hit or miss on new motherboards. Most motherboards don't ship with that. I had the same issue you were talking about. We had a MacBook Pro that we used in our workflow for quite a long time that I wanted to upgrade to faster processor model, but that was when they took away the FireWire port and we had to use the Express card slot for something else, I believe. So, and they took away both of those, I believe, in like kind of the latest edition of MacBook Pros. So we were stuck with, you know, the older generation machine. And also, I think your best bet is to look at the Lenovo business laptops or the HP business laptops, because those are your ones that we kind of mentioned earlier. They're going to have more connectivity options. They're going to retain things like FireWire and PC card. I think you'll be more likely to find one that will have an Express port or an Express card slot that you can put a FireWire adapter into than you will to find FireWire today. Like we actually have, That's what is sitting down here, actually. Here, this is a Dynex brand, so you know I bought this at Best Buy. And this is a Express card adapter that actually has two FireWire ports on it. I don't know if it'll focus on there. And in the middle is actually the power adapter for that exact reason you were mentioning, Roger, where if you have the smaller pin style, sometimes you need power for it as well. This is 1394A and B on this. So I think your best bet is to look for a laptop that has this. The other specifications should be doable. The only thing that might be harder is to get a 1080p
screen. Yeah. I'm really trying to figure if you can get any of that under $1,500 altogether in one package.
I think it's doable. The hardest part will be, I mean, Express card maybe is quite a bit easier to find.
I'm thinking just the high-end games at a reasonable level.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're talking about for the discrete GPU.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still think you'll be able to. I think look at the Asus laptops. MSI actually has some that aren't real popular or well-known yet, but they are known for having better discrete GPUs in them. And if you could find one that has a 1080p screen and an Express card slot for a device like this, you should be okay. But I think Roger's right. We'll kind of be on the edge of that $1,500 limit. Let's see. Let's take an email here from a cornered Canuck dad about system stuttering. It says, hi, guys. I know Christmas is coming up fast. Well, uh-oh. Hope we weren't way too late for this email. I've recently upgraded the majority of my system, 2600K, ASUS Z68 motherboard, 8 gigs of memory, and a Corsair 120 gig SSD. Budget and need at the time, I held off on upgrading my video card, which is a Sapphire 5750. I've been happy with it so far, except now. I'm not sure if it's jealous. I'm not sure if it's a Z68 Virtue software, but he says he's getting some, it keeps hanging and restarting. I've removed the drivers, reinstalled drivers, updated the BIOS, changed the Virtue software. It still gets twitchy, and strangely on the stupid routine websites or reading email or the occasional flash game for the kids, not during gaming sessions. Now my son will be getting Skyrim for Christmas on a 24-inch 1080p monitor. Will the 5750 be playable? Intended to upgrade to a 6850. There's two issues, I guess, is what he's asking about here. Is the 5750 going to be playable for Skyrim? Chances are he already knows the answer to this, but to anybody else that may be figuring that out, it will be playable at 1080p, but not at the top quality settings. The 6850 won't be a problem. If you get a 6850, you'll be able to play Skyrim at its top quality settings without a hitch. You know, the biggest kind of, we use Skyrim in our GPU testing here at PC Perspective, and the CPU seems to be a bottleneck in some particular instances, more so than the GPU, because the game tries to do so much in terms of drawing and artificial intelligence, and everything is supposed to be real and interacting with all this kind of stuff, that the CPU has a lot of that bottleneck, or a lot of that overhead, rather on it, rather than the GPU. So he says, no pressure or anything, but my son's Skyrim depends on it. As for the stuttering, it's really weird. He's saying he's getting twitchy and hanging and restarting while doing flash routine websites and reading email and stuff, but not during gaming sessions. That is fairly odd. That actually leads me to believe that maybe you were having issues with your SSD, with your storage solution. Did you have AHCI enabled when you install Windows on it? Are you maybe at capacity on the SSD that could also cause some of those potential issues?
I'm wondering if he did any updates prior. I mean, like when he got it, was it working fine or was it out of the gate kind of twitchy? True. Because if it was something, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of work backwards to when the last time that system, especially with some of the more elaborate ASUS, actually any motherboard from any, you know, Gigabit or MSI, the more features they tend to cram into it. And from personal experience, one of those things tends to kind of complicate issues. And it could be something where, I mean, is it possible to turn off some of the functions in the BIOS to see if it gets it working again, where you can kind of isolate if maybe it was something a feature of the board itself that might be causing an issue, if it's something that's relatively recent, or even if it was something that, you know, when you cobbled it together, it was acting the same way. The SSD would also check. I mean, if you're maxing out on it, and Windows likes space, especially for the swap disk. So, I mean, I'd look at that. Updated the BIOS. See, I'm wondering if maybe he had to go back the other way on the BIOS. Because occasionally, if you update to the latest BIOS, I've had this happen on one occasion with an ASUS board where it actually freaked out, and I actually had to downgrade it. I don't remember if I could downgrade it, but everything got flaky with the BIOS update. Reinstalled the drivers, removed the drivers, and so on. Have you retried reinstalling Windows? And I know that sounds kind of a last resort, but
hey, it could. Sometimes you got to do that. I think, honestly, to me, it sounds unfortunately like maybe it could be an SSD issue. I don't think he mentioned the specific model of SSD he was using.
Oh, he had the Corsair 3 120.
Yeah, I don't know what a Corsair 3 is.
Yeah, I don't know which.
I don't know if they have a Force 3. I think they do. In which case, that would be a SandForce driver. I would check that first. I would maybe see if clearing out space will help on that for the SSD and go from there. It's check around on forums and look for SSD stuttering, because that's kind of what it sounds like to me, more than likely, especially if it's not happening during games. You want to take this email from Daniel about noise dampening material? It's kind of interesting.
So Daniel writes, I was wondering if you had any experience using any of the various case foam / pad materials advertised for noise dampening. If so, what is your thought on their effectiveness and possible side effects in terms of temperature? I currently have a Corsair 700D, which I love, and noise is not actually a problem as the system is reasonably quiet overall. But if I can spend a small amount of money and see real improvement in noise levels, then it's something I may look into.
Have you ever used any of this type of stuff? I was just kind of looking around. On Newegg, they have some Silverstone silent foam dampening acoustic material. It's kind of expensive. You get two 21 by 15 inch pieces for about $20.
I've used auto insulation for car stereo installations. You know, that kind of material they usually pad out your car with. So when you get like a new bass or whatever, your whole car doesn't rattle. I have good luck with that, but one of the side effects I've noticed is it kind of turns it into a bit of a thermos. It gets hotter than normal depending on how much you use. Because, you know, like in my old case, it was just bare metal, so it would it would conduct the heat away. But once you start adding that little bit and over places, and you don't have good ventilation, you can get pretty toasty inside. So
Definitely need to make sure you have good fans. Like he's worried about noise levels, obviously. So you want good quality fans that are kind of maybe larger and spinning a little bit slower. So you don't have noisy fans with sound dampening material necessary. But it's sound dampening material will definitely help keep noise inside the case. But if your fans are loud, there's no point in putting sound dampening material. One thing sound dampening material can do is help with any kind of vibrations. It adds a little bit of weight to side panels. It can add weight to any of the doors or sliding mechanisms on it that will remove a lot of that, some of that vibration thing. One of the best places I think to go for this type of stuff is Frozen CPU. If you go to frozencpu.com, they have a whole section on sound dampening, looking at computer fan silencers, hard drive silencers, case silencing with Acoustipac, Lian Li. They have all kinds of different brands of this stuff. It's not particularly cheap. You're going to pay a little bit, and you're going to have to buy larger layers that you didn't cut out to fit your particular case. Yeah, Frozen CPU has a lot of that good kind of stuff. You know, you're looking at a three-layer sheet of Acoustipac Professional Series, like $22 in stock. But you're going to have to cut it to make it fit. You know, some cases from Antec, I know, is one of the big proponents of this, is they have sand dampening material already built in to their cases. At CES, Corsair announced the 550D case that has sound dampening material already installed on the internals of it as well. It's definitely helpful. And kind of like Roger was saying, it's a very similar idea as that you would put on, you know, on the inside of a car as well. So it's interesting stuff. It's one of those kind of things that I think maybe people should upgrade on their system or look to add to their system that you might not otherwise think of, because having a quiet system, even if you think your system's already quiet now, can definitely kind of change the way you look at your gaming PC. So
definitely, it's definitely an improvement.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me pick out one more of these emails. Email from Gavin about. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to quickly add to the Canadian dad who's having PC or computer issues, what you were saying about the SSD. If it is a SandForce drive, make sure Corsair doesn't have a firmware update for it. There were some issues with some SandForce controllers over time. It wasn't immediately apparent, but after use, it would start to crop up where you would have mysterious drive issues with it, and that could very well be what he was experiencing.
All right, let's do one more email from Gavin about a Windows home server build. He says he's planning on building his first home server with 2 terabyte green hard drive, a Core i3 processor, Z68 chipset, 4 gigs of memory, running Windows Home Server 2011 from Microsoft. It'll mostly be used for video streaming and backups, as well as cloud backup, Carbonite. My problem is I can't pick between mini ITX or full ATX. Mini ITX should be more power efficient, but the power supplies look cheap, and I've never had good experience with a cheap PSU. Should I just get a full ATX with a reliable power supply, or is there decent power supply options available for mini ITX cases? Love the show, and thanks for the advice.
My immediate question to Gavin is, where is this server going to live? If it's somewhere where it's going to be out of the way and you can afford to have a larger case, I would probably be more tempted to just get a full size, or not full size, but a case that can take a full size power supply. However, if you need it to be very inconspicuous and small, there are a couple of. Robert just recently built a home theater PC, which is not unlike what Gavin might want, using a mini ITX case board. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was a Silverstone
case. They make some good ones. I think we have the Silverstone Sugo SG05. It might have been what he used. And it kind of comes with the power supply already in it, a 450-watt, 80-plus bronze certified Silverstone is known to make high-quality power supplies themselves. I'm sure it's their own power supply in here. So the case combo with the power supply would be useful for that. This is a mini ITX. It's a little bit on the steep side, $120 for the case power supply combo, depending on what you're going for. One thing I will tell him is, from a power efficiency standpoint, it's not really going to matter. The processors are going to be the same, right, on either mini ITX or full ATX motherboards, and that's the biggest kind of power draw out there. So the CPU, when it's in idle, will use just as little power on the full ATX board as it will the mini ITX board. So I agree with Roger. If you have the space, it's kind of just easier, and it gives you more options if you use kind of a regular ATX motherboard. You'll have more room to install additional hard drives down the road, too, if you need to expand that past your initial single 2 terabyte drive. The Silverstone Sugo SG05 that I mentioned only has one internal 2.5-inch drive, one internal 3.5-inch drive. So you're kind of limited in terms of your expandability there. But if you're going to have to look at it every day, maybe you want it to be something smaller and you can afford to go with the smaller system there. I don't think you have to worry about the power supplies necessarily if you buy it from kind of a reputable manufacturer. I think we're past the days of buying the no-name power supplies with the cheap generic beige computer cases, thank goodness. Yeah.
Although beware of buying the really super cheap cases, because they still give you the dollar bin power supplies that might go out when you turn on the lights in your house. I say that because one of my coworker recently experienced a bad power supply, and she got it with her like $70 case. So, I mean, it's definitely better to spend a little bit more to get something more reputable from a supplier with a known reputation than to just kind of like, yeah, that looks good. You know, it's only $50. Right. You know, it's especially if it's a server, you definitely want to ensure that your power supply is not the first thing to go, because, you know, you could probably live with a broken motherboard, but if you have really, really important data on those drives, you don't want that to fry or freeze up or whatever, because in this day and age, I think people are going to agree that data is always more important than the hardware that it sits on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're using this as a backup machine, take that seriously. We're going to end the show there. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us. It was great to fill. Enjoy having you on here. Where can people find you?
So if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter at Jolly Roger. I'm also the producer for Techzilla, which Patrick is the co-host of. And you can find that at techzilla.com, at revision3.com/techzilla.
I think you have probably one of the better non-exact name Twitter handles of anybody I've ever seen. So congrats on that.
Yeah, I when someone offered me a it's like, oh, you should get on Twitter. It's like, okay, what does everyone have? Like, oh, crap, I'll take this instead. Yeah, no, I really lucked out. Unfortunately, there's also a bar in Portland that has the same name. So every time people go out carousing, they tweet, meet up at Jolly Roger's. Like, no, you're not meeting up at my house. No.
Yeah, please don't. No, don't do that. You can find me, of course, at PC Perspective, PCPer.com, or my Twitter handle is just my name, Ryan Shrout. You can follow me there. So that's going to be it for this week. We will see you next week for another edition of This Week Computer Hardware. Thanks for listening.
Bye.